So I would call him Professor Decker, but he is my uncle. So thanks, Uncle Bob, for the nice introduction. As my wife and I were getting ready to come over here, she asked me, "You know, you nervous? How you doing?" I told her I was doing all right. And then we pulled in the parking lot, and there were a few cars there already. And I rationalized that away by knowing that, well, I was going to talk to somebody. I knew there were going to be people out there. And then I sat down, and all you showed up, and I'm officially nervous. So I will do my best to not talk too fast and get through this here. So like you said, I'm a family doctor. That means I deliver babies, I take care of newborns, I see kids, adults. 2 weeks ago, I saw a lady who was 94 years old. So pretty much the whole gamut, the whole range of medicine. That means I'm not a psychiatrist and I'm not a counselor. However, because I do primary care and I see pretty much everything, a lot of times I'm the first person that someone will come to if they have symptoms that are bothering them. In fact, in our training, we're taught that 15 to 20% of the people we see will be on medications for things like bipolar disease, anorexia, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and of course, depression. I will routinely make the diagnosis of depression in the office, and again, that's simply for the reason that I'm the first one that they see. So I'm happy to have the opportunity to talk about this subject tonight. As I was making this talk and preparing for this, I would talk to the guys in the back of the church or other people that I ran across who knew I was doing this, and I'd ask them what they knew about depression, what they thought depression was. And some would say, well, it's when you're sad, right? And others, after thinking, would say, well, I know women get depressed after they have babies, that postpartum depression thing. And others would stumble and mumble a little bit and finally admit that they really didn't know what in the world depression was all about. So I think there's room for education, there's room for some instruction, and that's really what I intend to do tonight. A little disclaimer before I go any further. For those of you whose bulletin announcement sounded like everyone in faith was depressed, that's not true. We actually do okay over here. And the purpose of this talk is going to really focus on the first part of the title, what is depression? Defining what's going on, explaining what the symptoms are, how you make the diagnosis. Much less of the talk will have to do with what can a doctor do, but that is an important part, so I will cover that. I'm definitely not pushing medications, but I will certainly talk about them, because that also is an important part of it. And I'm certainly not trying to diagnose anyone with anything from behind the pulpit up here. However, if after you hear what I have to say, you think you may fit in this diagnosis that I've explained tonight, of course the first step would be to talk to your own doctor. Now, I knew I'd be in a Protestant Reformed church, standing up here on the podium, behind the pulpit, so I figured I just have to make this talk have 3 points. So I managed to shoehorn all the information into 3 distinct sections. First, we're going to talk about what is depression. Next, we're going to do some anatomy and physiology, because I think it's important to understand normal nerve function and normal brain function in order to understand depression and its treatment. And then the last part will be the treatment aspect of it all, the what can a doctor do part. So the first section, what is depression? First, you have to know what kind of depression I'm talking about. If you were to go on the internet and type in depression, you'd get a whole long list of different depression syndromes. There's kind of this low-lying, low-level, kind of smoldering depression that can last for years. There's other mild forms. There's a thing called seasonal affective disorder, is when people get depressed in the wintertime because the sun goes away. But what I want to talk about tonight is a major depressive episode. And the reason I picked this was because I think if you talk to someone who says, I've been depressed or I have depression, this is usually what they're talking about. So because it's the most common, that's what I'm going to discuss tonight. So by way of statistics, the first one is lifetime prevalence. And lifetime prevalence is simply the number of people or the percentage of people that will have a certain disease or a condition in their lifetime. And for depression, for a major depressive episode, that's 15 to 20%. So nearly 1 in 5 people will experience this kind of depression in their lifetime. We also know that women are affected about twice as much as men are. And about 10% for men, 20% for women. So anytime there's a difference between men and women, we always kind of wonder why, and hormones usually get blamed, and whether or not that's fair, I'm not sure. But in this case, it actually may be true. It may play a part in it. Women who are depressed report a worsening of their symptoms in the days prior to their monthly cycles. Another statistic, point prevalence. Point prevalence is the percentage of people that will have a certain disease or condition at one point in time. And for depression, that's 5 to 10%. So at any point in time, 5 to 10% of the population is going through a major depressive episode. So if the point of this talk is to simply raise awareness, to gain understanding, to educate, I think this might be the easiest way. The next time you're in church or a choir concert or a gym somewhere, remember that 5 to 10% of the people you see may be going through depression at that very time, and that up to 20% of the people in the room may experience depression in their lifetime. We know depression costs a lot of money. In 2004, the number I found was $80 billion. And that looks at cost of office visits and psychiatric visits, medications, lost wages, things like that. And last, by way of introductory kind of statistics, we know that different cultures view depression differently. If you were a Latino down in Latin America, they may say it's a problem with nerves. If you were in the Middle East, they may call it a problem with the heart. If you were in a tribe in Africa, you may be considered heartbroken. And of course, here in the United States, we have that lovely term, the chemical imbalance. And I will definitely talk more about that later on. So depression is a mood disorder, mood, M-O-O-D. And in order to understand the disorder of moods, it's important to understand what normal moods are. As we all know from experience, moods, there's a continuum of moods. You have the person who tends to be more sad on this side. You have the guy who's happy all the time over here, and then Steady Eddie in the middle, who doesn't get too excited about anything and doesn't let much get him down. We also know that we move all over. Some days we're happy, some days we're sad, and that's normal. But what are the disorders? On the happy side, essentially too happy, the disorder in this way is called mania, or being manic. Now, if you've heard of the term manic depression or bipolar, one of the poles of bipolar is mania. And that's the end that we'll talk about that, because it's not the subject for tonight. Over on the sad side, the disorder on the sad side of the mood is depression. And as we'll see, it's not just being sad, but that's the mood disorder over here. So what's the definition of a major depressive episode? Well, for one, it's not arbitrary. There's a book called The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM. And this is the fourth version, so it's the DSM-4. This is essentially the encyclopedia and dictionary of psychiatric illness. It gives statistics, it gives diagnostic criteria, tells us how to treat it. It's like I said, encyclopedia and dictionary. For depression, for a major depressive episode, this book says there's four criteria that you need to meet. The first has to do with symptoms. There are 9 distinct symptoms, and in order to be diagnosed with depression, you need to have 5 of the 9 symptoms for at least 2 weeks. Now, if you go through this book, any of the disorders that you read about in there's almost always this time qualifier, you know, at least 2 weeks. As we go through the symptoms, you may have these symptoms. One day you may fit every single one of these, but if it's only an hour or a day, that wouldn't be considered depression. There's always this extended amount of time that these things need to occur for. So the first symptom is the one that most people think about when they think depression. It's that depressed mood, most of the day, nearly every day. Now, before we go on, as I list these symptoms, you're going to hear a lot of words like most and nearly and almost all. So there is some wiggle room in the diagnosis. I don't know if most of the day means 10 hours or 12 hours or 15 hours. It's just most of the day. So this depressed mood, that can be expressed as feeling blah or down in the dumps. But it can also be expressed as things like anxiety or irritability or anger. And particularly in young people, like teenagers who are depressed, it's those last 3 symptoms, anxiety, irritability, anger, that can be, that's how it can be expressed. The second symptom is a bit of a mouthful. Markedly decreased interest or pleasure in all or almost all activities most of the day, nearly every day. In plain English, that simply means the things that you used to like to do, you don't like to do them anymore. If you were a shopper or a scrapbooker or a hunter or a bowler, whatever, things that you used to enjoy going to do, you don't like to do them anymore, you don't find pleasure in them, and therefore you stop doing them. This can lead to not caring anymore, can lead to social withdrawal, can lead to intimacy problems in the marriage because of the lack thereof. So it's an important symptom. Now remember back at the beginning, I said we need 5 out of 9 symptoms. Another requirement is that one of the 5 needs to be one of these first 2. You have to have a depressed mood, or you have to have this lack of pleasure in things you used to like to do. The third symptom has to do with weight, and it's significant weight loss or a decrease. People tend to be forced to eat, needed to be forced to eat, and obviously that results in weight loss. Fourth symptom has to do with sleep. And most of the time this results in insomnia. Sometimes it can result in hypersomnia or sleeping too much, but more often than not, it's actually not enough sleep. And I was surprised to find as I was doing my research for this and reading on this that it's not usually initially falling asleep at night. That tends to be okay. It's more often than not waking up in the middle of the night or in the early morning hours and not being able to fall back asleep. But of course, any kind of insomnia would qualify. The fifth symptom is, again, kind of medical speak and kind of a mouthful. It's psychomotor agitation or retardation nearly every day as witnessed by others. So we'll break that one down. Psychomotor agitation. It's just what the word says, agitation. It's pacing or things like hand wringing. That's the agitation part. Or it's retardation, psychomotor retardation, meaning slowing. Things like slowed speech, slowed thinking, more pauses in their speech, loss of inflection in the voice. And the key with this symptom is that last 4 words, as witnessed by others. The depressed person may feel like they're walking through mud, pulling weights behind them, but actually still functioning at a normal level. This symptom actually is where people who live with them, their associates say you've slowed down, you're not functioning like you used to function. The sixth symptom has to do with energy, and it's fatigue or loss of energy nearly every day, where the smallest tasks require the largest effort. Things like getting out of bed, making breakfast, going to the mailbox require an enormous amount of energy and effort. The seventh symptom deals with feelings of worthlessness, inappropriate guilt nearly every day. This can be manifested by dwelling on past decisions or an exaggerated sense of responsibility where you're blaming yourself for all the problems. The eighth symptom has to do with concentration, and it's simply a diminished ability to diminished ability to think, concentrate, or make decisions. And the last symptom is probably the most serious. It's recurrent thoughts of death, thoughts of suicide without a plan, or even a suicide attempt. This can be very variable, from thinking the world is better off without me to making a plan or finding a gun or something like that. So that's the first criteria. It's this symptom package that you need to have. And you can see right away that depression can wear many hats. It's just 5 of these 9 symptoms. It could present in multiple different ways and affect multiple different areas of life. The second criteria, as given by that DSM-IV, that book again, is that the symptoms are not due to the direct effect of a substance, meaning it's not drug-induced or it's not alcohol-induced, and it cannot be due to a general medical condition. If your thyroid was off and wasn't working like it should, you could experience many of these symptoms. That would not be depression. That would be hypothyroidism, and we would treat that differently than depression. The third criteria is that the symptoms are not accounted for by bereavement, or that is the loss of a loved one. Obviously, there's times in life when it's normal to feel these symptoms that I just listed. You know, I think I should have gotten something for my cough. If anyone could have something, it should be me, but anyway. That third symptom. The symptoms cannot be accounted for by grieving or bereavement. And there are times when it's normal to feel these symptoms. And the DSM-IV, that book, says about a 2-month window is a time period when the grieving would be considered normal. Now, that does not mean that on day number 60 you're grieving and on day 61 you're depressed. It's not quite that rigid of a requirement, but it gets you kind of in the ballpark. And the last criteria is probably the one that if you talk to someone who's depressed, this is the part that was the most tough for them. And it's the idea that symptoms cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other areas of functioning. Despite trying to overcome these feelings, despite knowing that these feelings are starting to affect life, and affect other areas of life, the depressed person
can't just get over it. They can't just snap out of it. They can't just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get through it. And it starts to affect their marriage, their family life, their work life, church life, whatever. It affects other areas of life. And that's, again, a requirement for making the diagnosis. So in summary, it's not just being sad. There are many different things affected. It's a constellation of symptoms. And of course, it affects these other areas of life. Other characteristics. It's relapsing and remitting. If you have a major depressive episode, there's a 40% chance you'll have another one in 2 years. If you have two episodes, there's a 75% chance you'll have another one within 5 years. So for all of us who aren't depressed or who know someone who is, this is important because it's more likely than not that they may experience it again. There are risk factors for depression. Neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, and seizure disorder increase your risk of being depressed. We certainly know there's a genetic component, a genetic disposition. And that just comes simply from experience. For those of us who know people who are depressed, you see it in grandpa, you see it in the son, you see it in grandson. We know that it runs in families. So that's looking at it one way. What does depression increase your risk for? What about the other, or what are the risk factors that increase depression? What about the other way around? Does depression increase your risk for other things? And the answer is yes. You had an increased risk for heart attacks and for strokes, and probably other things, but I didn't have time to look all that up. Now, I do want to comment about postpartum issues, because that seems to be kind of the hot button thing of the day. Everyone has heard of someone who's had postpartum depression or knows about it. And with postpartum issues, again, we have a continuum. There's postpartum blues, which is the most mild form. There's postpartum depression, which is, we'll call, moderate. And postpartum psychosis, which is the most severe and also the least frequent. That's where you lose touch with reality and you have irrational thoughts and out of the scope of what we're talking about tonight. The numbers that I found were up to 85% of women will have some sort of mood disorder postpartum. Most have this minor postpartum blues. That occurs 3 days to 2 weeks after you have the baby. 40 to 80% of women can have this. And it's characterized as with mild, rapid mood swings, irritability, anxiety, limited concentration, insomnia, and tearfulness. The key with this, though, is that it doesn't tend to interfere with the ability to care for the child. Postpartum depression, on the other hand, is no different than the depression I just described before. You still need the 5 and 9 symptoms. You still need all the other criteria. The only special thing is that it happened, the time period when it occurs, and that's postpartum. The treatment is the same as this normal or regular depression. But the key with this is it may interfere with the mother's ability to care for the child. And again, for those of us who aren't depressed or who know someone who's had a baby, it's important to understand that this may happen. And if they do have postpartum depression, that may be, or there may be specific needs and cares that family may need. So that's what I know about depression by way of definition and statistics and things like that. Now we'll go on to the anatomy and physiology part of it. And like I said before, I think it's important to understand, in order to understand the physical aspect of depression and its treatment, we need to understand how the brain functions, basic brain neurology and nerve function. Now, in spite of the fact I know that my audience has a broad range of education and that this will be review for some people, I'm going to assume very little education as I explain this. So simple neurology, there's two different parts. There's nerves, and most people know about nerves because they've heard of the sciatic nerve or a pinched nerve in the back or in the neck, or they know the spinal cord is a big cord of nerves. Then there's this other part called neurotransmitters. And neurotransmitters are chemicals that are released by the nerves so that the signal can be passed on to the next nerve. As we know, our body is not one continuous nerve. There's multiple, and the signal, the impulse, needs to move to the next nerve. That's what those neurotransmitters do. The best way to look at this is with the example that's in every textbook and in every class I think I've ever been in. It's when you put your finger on the hot stove, what happens? So when I forget that the burner is hot and I touch the stove with my finger, what happens down there? Well, there's a nerve in the tip of your finger and its job is to sense temperature. And it senses that it's hot. So in the tip of your finger, there's a chemical change that occurs. sodium and potassium. The sodium that's in the salt on your kitchen table, the potassium that was in the banana you had for lunch, start to change places in that nerve, causing a chemical change. Fat causes a chemical change further up the nerve, which causes another chemical change further up. It's essentially like knocking over a row of dominoes. Once the process starts, away it goes up your arm. Then it reaches your neck, where it needs to pass the information onto your spinal cord. That chemical change hits the end of the nerve. The neurotransmitters are released. They move across. They hit the second nerve, causing the chemical change again, and the next row of dominoes falls, and it travels up to your brain. That makes its way up to your brain, and your brain, the part of your brain whose job it is to sense what is going on in the tip of your finger, realizes that it's hot and says, that's not a good thing. We probably ought to move the finger off the stove. Creates another impulse that goes back down. Same thing. Rows of dominoes fall. The neurotransmitters are released. They swim across the gap. And the impulse makes it down to your forearm. When it gets to the muscle, causes the muscle to contract, and you pull your finger off the stove. Now, you may say that's an awfully simplistic view of how nerves work in neurology, and I admit it is. But its beauty is its simplicity. It's an absolutely amazing design. We all know how quickly that happens where you put your finger on the stove and you pull it off. 250 miles an hour is the speed that it goes up your arm and comes back down. So this process occurs thousands and thousands and probably millions of times a day. Every movement, every sense. When you put that piece of candy in your mouth tonight to keep yourself awake, it created a chemical change in the nerve in your tongue, and that made it up to your brain, and your brain interpreted that as Lifesaver or Lemon Drop or whatever you used. When you walked home tonight and you went in the kitchen and you smelled dinner cooking, those molecules of smell made it into your nose, caused a chemical change, that same thing, sodium and potassium in your nose, followed the nerve up to your brain, and the part of your brain that's job it is to interpret smell, interpreted chicken or turkey or whatever was cooking. The brain also talks to itself this way. It's constantly firing signals back and forth within the brain. There are regulatory parts of the brain that have to do with heart rate and breathing, which is very important to all of us, and hunger. The brain is very ordered and very mappable, and I know I made that word up, but the brain is exceedingly consistent. If there ever was a system in your body that is the same from one person to the next, it's the nervous system. There are definite areas in the brain that deal with sight and speech and sensation. But we also know there are areas that deal with desires and personality and mood. And remember, all these functions, every function of the human body, is carried out by nerve signals that are passed back and forth by neurotransmitters. So why in the world mention all this and go through all this science stuff? First, it's so you can be impressed by the design of the human body, and in doing so, give honor to our Creator. This is just one system and a very small part of one system. But you can look at any system of the body and be equally amazed. It's simply amazing that we can continue to take one breath after the other. There are so many things that have to go right for that to happen. And again, it points to the majesty of our Creator. The second reason for knowing this has to do with treatment. So the scientists and doctors had a theory. We can either affect the nerves or we can affect the neurotransmitters. They picked the neurotransmitters, and that's where the medications for the depression come from. So that gets me to the third part, which is what medical help is available. And before I get to the treatment options of medications and counseling, I think one of the big things that the medical world can provide is a diagnosis. Sometimes this is half the battle. Simply putting a term or a diagnosis to these symptoms that someone's been feeling gets them moving from the path of what in the world is going on, what is wrong with me, to turning the corner and coming back to now how are we going to get better? You know, and also ruling out those things like thyroid disease and things like that, which can also cause these symptoms. So simply making a diagnosis is one thing. The next medical help that is available is medications. Now, these affect the neurotransmitters that I was explaining before. The old medications affected most of them, and that led to tons of side effects, so those quickly fell out of favor. Then the scientists narrowed it down to one neurotransmitter, and its name is serotonin, and it's not important that you remember that, but that neurotransmitter tends to deal with emotions and sleep and appetite. There are a few other minor culprits, but serotonin is the big one. And the medications that many of you know the names of, because they advertise like crazy all over the place, Things like Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft, those all affect that serotonin, that one neurotransmitter. And this is where that term chemical imbalance came into being. The thought was, these neurotransmitters or chemicals must be imbalanced, so let's make a medicine that just balances them out. Well, I'm not a big fan of the term, because the assumption is that, so yeah, you take the medicine, the balance, or the imbalance becomes balanced, and away you go. Well, that doesn't necessarily happen, and I'll speak a little bit more of that in a minute. So do these medicines work? Some say it's all in your head. Mind over matter, right? These meds don't really work, do they? Well, in the medical world, we go to the studies. So good studies in patients take a group of patients, say 200 folks who are depressed. You divide them into two groups, 100 in each. One group, you give the medicine. One group, you give a fake pill, a sugar pill. It's called a placebo. And the groups don't know what they're getting. So you give them the medicine and you watch what happens. There are all sorts of these studies out there that deal with the antidepressants that look at it this way. So what are the results? 60% of the patients who were taking the real medicine had improvement at 6 weeks' time. 40% of the patients who took the sugar pill had improvement at 6 weeks. We also found out that it may take 1 to 6 weeks to work, and from experience, it's more like 4 to 6 weeks. So that gets us back to that chemical imbalance thing. We know the medicines work right away. The serotonin levels, the neurotransmitter levels, balance out fairly quickly, but it tends to take longer for the symptoms to resolve. So it's not just as easy as balancing your imbalance. So that always begs the question, why in the world would you take a medicine that only affords a 20% improvement versus taking a sugar pill? 40% got better with taking that fake pill that was nothing. That's not good medicine, is it? Well, before you discount the medicine because the fake pill worked, you have to know that no matter what you study, high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, strep throat, it doesn't matter. The fake pill always works. There are always people in that group that get better. So therefore, just discounting the medicine because of the fake pill group worked wouldn't be a logical reason. The medications usually result in a quicker recovery. The natural course of the disease is that it resolves in about 4 to 6 months. With medications, you may have improvement at 4 to 6 weeks. For severe depression, it is the treatment of choice, is what the books say we need to use for severe depression. But remember, it's only one of two options. There's this other option of counseling. For mild to moderate depression, counseling has been shown to be as effective as the medicines. Not taking out the severe again. Just the mild to moderate depression has been shown to be as effective. The studies usually looked at counseling with a licensed psychologist. They've also looked at doing both. What happens, the sum of the parts should be better, right? Well, it actually didn't work out that way. The combination wasn't necessarily any better than using one or the other of medicines versus and counseling. The trick with this all is that I can't order a lab test and I can't order a brain scan or anything like that to determine if you're going to respond to medicines or you're going to respond to counseling. There's just no way of knowing it, so it's simply a trial and error thing. So what's going on? What causes this depression? Medications make it better sometimes. Counseling makes it better. Sometimes it gets better on its own. Is it a chemical imbalance? Is it a physical problem? Is it a mental problem or spiritual problem? Or is it both or all? This is when I had my Brian, what in the world have you gotten yourself into moment while preparing this speech. Obviously, this is a question that many people want answered. And I know there are many opinions out there regarding the cause or basis of depression. Because of that fact, I'm going to tread very lightly as I proceed here. Regarding the question, what causes depression, there is no easy, cut and dried answer to this. And the reading and research that I was able to do, nearly every source I looked at said essentially the same thing. We don't know the specific cause, but we do know there are genetic, there are biological or chemical differences, and there are environmental, that is the world you live in, the people you're associated with, your life that you live. There are all three of those factors that play into the illness. But obviously the medical and scientific world is not looking at depression from a godly perspective. What about the spiritual aspect? What about the soul? What about the question of is it sin or is it sickness? Obviously, I have a medical degree, and I am going to happily leave the questions about those things to the men with the theological degrees who are speaking tomorrow. But I'd like to finish with my perspective as a Christian doctor. We all go to work every day. We do the same jobs that the world does, but we look at it from a different perspective. So I want to give you mine regarding this. Depression is suffering. Look at the list. Physical suffering, mental anguish, painful thinking, guilt, agitation, sleep issues. The depressed patient or depressed person is most certainly suffering physically and mentally. And God has given us treatments to help with depression, just as He has given us treatments to help with pneumonia and strep throat and diabetes. If I have a patient suffering from depression, I'll tell them of both options, medications and counseling, and we'll work together to figure out the best way to go about trying to make it better. But I believe there is more to the treatment of depression than what the medical and scientific world teaches. They are missing a key aspect of treatment, and I'm speaking of the spiritual aspect. This part of the patient's life, or the person's life, needs to be addressed. Besides medications and counseling, I believe every depressed person can benefit from spiritual help. And this will be addressed more tomorrow, so I will be brief. I don't necessarily think that the person needs to go from the doctor's office directly to the pastor's study. As we'll see tomorrow, and as we already know today, there is great comfort to be found in the Bible. And that is very necessary for the depressed person. For the mildly depressed person, it may be a focused time of devotion. It may be an increased time, amount of time spent in prayer, or some or time discussing God's Word with friends and family. This sort of activity can be exceedingly beneficial in the treatment of depression. So, there is more to the story than just the medical side of it. There are things that the depressed person can do, and there are things, certainly ways, in which friends and relatives can help. For that information, you'll have to wait until tomorrow. Thank you all for your attention tonight.